Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Brett Mabee. If there's a bird associated with this time of year, it's the turkey. They're a source of food, yes, but they are more than that to many tribes. Native people domesticated turkeys in North America long before Europeans arrived. Several tribes have turkey clans, and they show up in a number of traditional stories. Coming up this hour, we'll get several perspectives on the cultural significance of turkeys. We are back right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. South Dakota has struggled to establish a network of foster parents in tribal communities. Solutions include a space where Native children can feel close to home, Mike Moen reports.
Over the years, South Dakota has been criticized for often placing Indigenous children with white families through aggressive custody hearings. That has inspired outreach efforts to recruit foster parents in tribal areas. On the Cheyenne River Reservation, organizer Marcella Gilbert is working with the nonprofit Simply Smiles, which has been building homes for local kids in need of care. She stresses giving kids a professional and nurturing support system even when they turn 18.
It isn't like, okay, you're done, see you. It's like, okay, let's talk about what you want to do here. Do you want to go to college? Do you want to go to job training? You know, what do you want to do? We'll help you do that.
Gilbert says because the foster care system isn't aligned with Native American culture, these homes allow kids to maintain their identity. Prospective foster parents are trained to care for the kids through therapy and other standard practices. But Gilbert says only 6 homes are being built, so the occupants don't feel like they're in a residential setting. So far, 3 are finished. Simply Smiles communications manager Alex Gross says by offering an environment steeped in Lakota traditions, kids are likely to have a greater sense of belonging, even if they dealt with trauma in the past.
We are doing everything to make sure that they remain with their kin and community. That includes working with a team of Lakota elders. We call them the grandmothers group.
Simply Smiles urges local families interested in becoming trained foster parents to visit the group's website. Statewide, the Department of Social Services has launched a campaign to recruit more foster families in tribal areas. Department Secretary Lori Gill sees hope in reaching their goal of 300.
We have met 42% of our first-year goal, and we launched this in May. So we're very pleased with the progress.
That was Mike Moen reporting. Idaho's first large-scale solar battery from Tesla has been installed by the Nez Perce tribe. The Tesla Megapack is about the size of a shipping container and will store energy from solar panels to power the tribe's wastewater treatment plant. Josh Powell is head of the company RevoluSun, which brought the battery to the tribe. He says it reduces dependence on hydropower dams in the region.
So it gives the community a lot more resilience, but it also allows people like the Nez Perce to control their energy where it's being produced, where they have lands. And traditionally, Native American lands, the grid is the weakest on their lands. So it's a natural place to create that support.
The tribe's calling for the removal of 4 dams on the Lower Snake River to protect fish populations. The Senate has confirmed Charles Sams III to serve as director of the National Park Service. Sams will be the first Native American to lead the National Park Service. He has worked with tribes throughout the Pacific Northwest, serving in state and tribal government roles and in natural resource and conservation management fields. Sams is from the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla. He was confirmed by a voice vote Thursday. The U.S. Forest Service has announced a proposal to restore roadless rural protections to the Tungus National Forest in Alaska. The Forest Service will start accepting public comments next week. Southeast Alaska Native leaders have supported the rule, seeking protections for resources where their communities harvest food. The rule restricts development. It would reverse a rollback put in place under the Trump administration. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
There are now booster recommendations for all three available COVID-19 vaccines in the United States, and you may choose which booster shot you receive. More info at aaip.org or cdc.gov/coronavirus, who support this show.
Support by BNSF Railway, proudly supporting the nation's economy by moving the goods that feed, supply, and power communities across the country. More at bnsf.com/tribal relations.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Brett Mabee. It's almost time to start thawing out your frozen turkey for next week's holiday feast. And as you're preparing to celebrate the traditions of the coming weeks, we will take this hour to offer some cultural wisdom that goes beyond the centerpiece of the Thanksgiving table. Turkeys are often depicted in Native origin stories and have a special place in culture and in ceremony. They're also a regulated species managed by tribal game and natural resource programs. That's because wild turkeys were pushed to near extinction by overhunting and habitat destruction. Conservation efforts have since successfully helped the bird once again flourish on their own in much of North America. So, how are turkeys significant to your native community and culture? Are they part of hunting traditions or your regalia? You're always welcome to give us a call and join our conversation. We're at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us from Minneapolis, Minnesota is Derek Nicholas. He's the founder of Weesenig LLC and the Nutrition Program Coordinator at the Division of Indian Work. And he's Red Cliff. Welcome to Native America Calling, Derek.
Bonjour, Derek Indigenous Cause, Minnewalk and Ndujuba, Slava Kana Jukati, Ishkunagin Wajibayan. Hello, everybody. My name is Derek. I'm from the Milwaukee area, and I'm from Red Cliff, and I live in Minneapolis now. I just want to thank you for having me here today.
We get to have a lot of important cultural conversations, and today's no exception, but we get to lighten the tone up a little bit and have some fun. And of course, I want to start, Derek, by asking you, well, I'm going to set the scene a little bit more. We're talking with guests from all over Turtle Island today, and Derek, I want to start by asking you how turkeys are significant to your culture.
Yeah, so I'm Ojibwe. We're from the Great Lakes region, and it didn't have too much of a vital role for us in our culture. Turkey kind of started up from down south and worked its way up north. I know it was a vital food source for the Lakotas, but I talked to some elders recently because I want to prepare for this call, and what they had to share with me is that when they were young, there were no turkeys in Minnesota. Due to the act of colonization, colonizers, they used food as a weapon. They deforested a lot of the land and killed a lot of the animals. And unfortunately, it led to the mass killing of turkeys. But now turkeys have made a comeback and they're doing well.
Derek, were the elders in your community able to share any insight on how, when they were reintroduced back into your area?
Well, she said that I referred to Hope Flanagan, and she said that there were none when she was a kid, but then when she was a teenager, she saw her first one.
And this was a not necessarily a tribally sponsored initiative to bring the turkeys back. This is just kind of one of those things that ended up happening after everybody stopped killing them all off, yeah.
Yeah, I believe so.
And as far as you saying that they didn't necessarily have too much significance historically, what kind of a role do they play now? Are they hunted, or do you include them in any regalia? Or
yeah, they are. They provide really good sustenance and nutrition for us. Actually, the first Thanksgiving, turkeys were introduced to the Starving Pilgrims, the Wampanoag Indians. They gifted the Starving Pilgrims turkey, beer, and fish to eat for this first Thanksgiving. Other than that, I know that the Six Nations, they use turkey feathers a lot. They use it at their ceremonies, powwows, and dances like the smoke dances.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. In fact, Haudenosaunee people, I'm not too knowledgeable about turkeys, and I don't want to pretend like I am, but they certainly have always played an important role up here. And it is my understanding, at least from an oral tradition perspective, that they were introduced into our region in the Six Nations territories about 2,000 years ago. They are, at least for us, the oldest domesticated animal as well. And I had heard that there are genetic links to some of the lineages that still exist in Mexico. And I think that's what I wanted to try and open up about today's conversation. You seem to have a general understanding of a lot of the different ways in which indigenous nations have reverence for this bird.
Like I said, I'm not too knowledgeable about this either. I just refer to some elders, but I know how to cook a turkey, that's for sure.
Joining us from Los Alamos, New Mexico is Dr. Siler Conrad. He's an archaeologist and tribal technician liaison at Los Alamos National Laboratories. Welcome to Native America Calling, Siler.
Hi, Brett, and hi, Derek, as well. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Siler, how did you come to focus on turkeys?
That's a great question. When I started my graduate program at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque, my dissertation advisor, Dr. Emily Lena Jones, really got me interested in and inspired to start working on some research that involved kind of investigating this past human-turkey relationship through time. And I really owe it to her to kind of inspire this interest and start me on this process of trying to understand much more about turkeys.
And in your research, you published a paper called Contextualizing Ancestral Pueblo Turkey Management. What is this specific paper about? And tell us a little bit more about the historical a connection to indigenous nations and turkeys.
Yeah, happy to. You know, this paper was really a large review of some of the archaeological evidence for how ancestral Pueblo peoples here within the Southwest kept and managed turkeys over time. And I was really interested in trying to understand the diversity in this record and really highlight how indigenous peoples have kept turkeys, fed turkeys. They have had this long, long-term relationship with the birds and integrated them into indigenous societies for well over 2,000 years. And so this paper was trying to really take a new focus and examine this record and try and gain some new information to gauge what that role of pinning and management was for turkeys within these past societies.
So the bulk of your work dealt with the archaeological record. Did you find any opportunities to be able to consult with the various nations on some of what their histories include?
Yeah, that's a great question. And for this paper in particular, in this research project, I intentionally did not, but only because of the diversity that's so clearly present in this record. And what I wanted to try and do here is to kind of reframe this question and the relationship between past peoples and turkeys by reviewing what was already known, already published, and try and capture that record in a way that could as I argue in the paper, reconceptualize this relationship. And so, you know, I thought that because of my lack of really knowledge of the diversity within different indigenous communities within the Southwest, but also the sort of what we know today as the Eastern United States, you know, I did not want to kind of overgeneralize what is clearly a very complex and dynamic relationship between different Native American groups and this bird throughout all of this region.
Well, needless to say, I'm sure there's a lot that can be gleaned just from the archaeological record. What were some of the surprising findings?
It's remarkable. Roughly 2,000 years ago, all of a sudden in the archaeological record, we see evidence for a Pueblo domesticated turkey that is living, is being exploited, has a relationship with ancestral peoples, while at the same time, those peoples were also consuming and exploiting wild turkeys here within the Southwest. And so, as you were previously mentioning, Brett, it's really fascinating, the wild Merriam's turkeys here within essentially the Southwest New Mexico in this region, that was not the progenitor of the Pueblo domesticated turkey that all of a sudden shows up at least by roughly 2,000 years ago. And this really speaks to the, you know, kind of inherent complexity with understanding, you know, these past relationships, especially since Pueblo peoples, indigenous peoples, were able to interact and kept two different types of birds, and they integrated those birds into their societies in similar but also different ways.
And different societies had different reverences or different degrees of reverence for the bird as well, yeah?
Yes, yep, exactly. And I think one way, in a very narrow archaeological perspective, we can glean some information from that by identifying really different ways that turkeys show up in archaeological context. And so throughout these past, you know, roughly 2,000 years here in the Southwest, we see turkeys that are occasionally penned within formal plaza pens in plaza pueblos. We see turkeys showing up in essentially room context and habitation spaces where they would have been close to these to sort of their care keepers, but also we see turkeys that are sort of let to free roam and are ranging in the environment, and all of these different types of contexts are changing through time, and we see them appearing in different times and places throughout this region. So it really speaks to this dynamic relationship.
Sure. Dr. Conrad, I have a few more questions for you before our time is up. And as we get into the break, talking about the different significance that various nations have for it, I do want to bring on Candace Quam. And the Zuni people do not, in fact, hunt turkeys. We'll talk more in just a few. We have to go to a quick break. We'll be right back. I'm your host, Brett Mamie.
Millions of dollars in COVID relief money is earmarked for tribal language preservation. Projects range from language immersion schools to comprehensive outreach programs. We'll get a snapshot of some of the language revitalization efforts emerging with the help of federal money on the next Native America Calling.
The Association of American Indian Physicians and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention remind you there are now booster recommendations for all three available COVID-19 vaccines in the United States. You may choose which COVID-19 vaccine you receive as a booster shot. Getting the COVID-19 vaccination protects you, your family, and your community. More information at aaip.org or cdc.gov/coronavirus, who support this show.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Brett Mabee. We're talking about the cultural significance of turkeys today. Are turkeys a part of your creation stories, or are they an animal you hunt around this time of year? As always, join our conversation by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Dr. Conrad, before we bring in our next guest, I do want to continue with this paper that you published, Contextualizing Ancestral Pueblo Turkey Management. We talked a little bit about some of the interesting things that you gleaned from this research, but I want to talk about some of the suggestions as well. Does this paper, in fact, suggest that turkeys are not indigenous to North America?
Oh, that's a great question. No, you know, I hope that as folks read this paper, what they will gain from this is that turkeys are really an indigenous bird. This is this is a Native American bird. There is such a very close relationship within the Southwest between ancestral peoples, modern indigenous peoples, but also in the, again, sort of eastern United States and within Mexico or what we might term Mesoamerica, sort of south of us here. You know, this is a bird that is from this land, from this region, and it's so closely tied to really the importance and the role of the past culture and societies here. I really believe quite strongly that there is just a really important tie that makes this bird just an indigenous bird for the peoples of this land.
What are some of your thoughts? I mean, out of all birds, why the turkey?
Yeah, you know, turkeys to me are just amazingly resilient. And I think something that's special is that if you, you know, from my own perspective today, you know, turkeys might come to you, they might sort of hang around you. They're quite interested in food, for example. They, you know, they have their own agency in the sense that they would like to gain some things from people. But I think that it's the bond between these birds and that closeness and that relationship in the many ways that turkeys were both used, but also the ways that turkeys existed within past societies. I think the representational and iconographic record is really a critical component of this. And so turkeys held this role that was separate from human individuals, but they really had quite a significant place within these societies. And we see that, and again, these archaeological contexts based on the ways that they were kept and cared for and really managed over time. And I hope that the paper speaks to some of that.
Who do you hope is learning from this research? What benefit can we bring it into the modern conversation?
Yes, I really hope that this paper both reaches a kind of an academic and public audience. It's published as an open access paper, so it should be free to read, just a quick search online. But one thing that I really hope is that as us as archaeologists, as others, even as, you know, sort of game managers today, understanding that what happened in the post-contact settler colonial world really impacted to a great degree turkey populations, just as those actions and activities severely impacted indigenous populations throughout these lands. And so I think that there's a very close connection between turkeys and sort of the sovereign role that indigenous peoples have within today North America to sort of have the ability to manage this relationship. And really, as Derek was talking about, sort of this repopulation and revitalization of bringing back turkeys within to these environments where they lasted for millennia but were then essentially wiped out or pushed out post-contact.
Dr. Conrad, and the paper is Contextualizing Ancestral Pueblo Turkey Management, widely available. So kind of tying this all in, how knowledgeable are you about the U.S. historical history, I guess, if you will, of turkeys as well, going back to the colonial era?
Yeah, you know, it's quite a tragedy what happened to turkeys within this land because, of course, at essentially contact, and I'm talking Western European contact into the eastern United States, turkeys were essentially brought over. But those turkeys were ones that were taken by the Spanish from Mexico, Mesoamerica, taken back to Europe. They were interbred and then essentially brought back to these lands. Then there was an extensive period of overhunting, landscape manipulation, things that really damaged and decreased the abundance of turkeys in the land. And so I think that we're really missing a clear and accurate picture of what past turkey sort of distribution is in this area. And I think that plays a role, for example, where I grew up in Spokane, Washington. There are turkeys there, but those turkeys were all introduced during the 20th century. And remarkably, some of those turkeys were probably introduced from the Southwest, and some of those Southwest turkeys most likely had a sort of surviving genetic signal from the Pueblo domesticated birds. And so even today, the modern management of these turkeys is really moving and kind of changing and impacting what is originally this very clear indigenous role in the management of these birds.
Dr. Conrad, one more question before we bring our next guest on. It's clear that you have a deep reverence for these birds that came about through your research. Would you go as far, I mean this in a very lighthearted way, would you even go as far to suggest that we find a new feast bird or meal?
Yes, I certainly would. I would hope that we can, within the United States, sort of separate our dependence on really the myth of Thanksgiving with this connection to turkeys. And I think that the millions, I think one estimate is roughly 40 million turkeys that are consumed every Thanksgiving. It is just an enormous impact onto those animals. And again, those animals that are the farm-raised turkeys that most people are buying today, those are actually genetically related to these domesticated turkeys that came from indigenous peoples in Mesoamerica. And so I really do hope that kind of our dependence, our understanding, and this relationship that we have today with turkeys might change in the future.
You're listening to Native America Calling. Today we're having a lighthearted yet important and fun cultural discussion about the history of turkeys among indigenous peoples. Are you aware of your tribe's history of domesticating turkeys? Of course, we want to hear from you. Give us a call right now at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And as always, there are plenty more ways to reach us. You can email us at comments@nativeamericacalling.com, and you can find us on our Facebook page at Native America Calling. We'll get your comments on the air. And joining us from Zuni, New Mexico, is Candace Quam. She's an artist, and she's Zuni. Welcome to Native America Calling, Candace.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be on.
I appreciate you taking a little bit of time to share your knowledge about turkeys. And as we have been alluding to throughout the conversation, various indigenous nations have different relationships to varying degrees. And not all communities or peoples, nations, hunt the bird. In fact, the Zuni are among those who have a special kind of reverence for them. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how significant the turkey is to your culture.
Sure. So just to start off, turkeys are actually one of the clans here. So we do have a turkey clan, and we actually use most of the turkey. We actually don't really eat them, except for when our people were starving or in dire straits. That's the only time we ate turkeys. Other than that, we would keep them around for their feathers, use them for regalia, for ceremonial purposes, also for their down, for use as blankets ancestrally. And they were actually roaming around the village like res dogs are now. So they were actually kind of free roaming, and they could pretty much do whatever they want, and we wouldn't do anything to them. So, and there's some actually pictures of that in our museum here in Zuni.
I think somebody needs to get a hold of...
Oh,
no, sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no. You sounded like it was going to be pretty good. Go ahead.
Not pretty good. I'm trying to make a joke. It probably fall on my face. I was going to say it sounds like somebody needs to get a hold of Sterling Harjo and Taika Waititi and start a television show called Res Turkeys, right, instead of Res Dogs. if we want to be a little bit historically accurate. Candace, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I wanted you to please share a little bit more. What you're comfortable sharing anyway.
Oh, sure. No problem. So as I said before, we didn't really eat them like for food substance. We just kind of kept them for their feathers and other things that they provide us. So we gave them a proper burial as we would a person, just to give them that reverence and to give them thanks for what they've done for us.
No. It's your turn.
Okay, but there's also a strand of turkey, a lineage of turkey that we brought from the Southwest, or not the Southwest, the South America, as part of our trade routes. And how we got our trade routes from South America is during our migration story, before we found our forever home where we are now, we were given two eggs, and we are a whole people as Zuni. We kind of took a look at each egg, and one of the eggs was really beautiful and really shiny. That was a really beautiful egg. And the other egg was really kind of dull and ugly color. And so we split up into two groups. Whoever wanted to follow the, whatever hatched out of the beautiful egg, but follow that one. And whatever hatched out of the really kind of dull egg, but follow that one. So the present day Zuni, where we are now, we picked the really beautiful and colorful egg. And out of that egg came a really black and kind of glistening crow. And that flew towards the direction of where our home is now. And what came out of the really dull and kind of ugly egg came out a really beautiful macaw. And that group that chose that egg went down towards South America. So that's kind of how we created that trade route. Yeah.
And taking that a step further, this is not just some anecdote that somebody shared. We're talking the Zuni creation story, the origin story, yeah?
Yeah, so we do have a, in our creation story, we have sort of multiple parts in that story. We have our emergence story, our migration story, and there's also different stories that kind of lead us to how we got to our forever home now.
Candace, kind of following on that same trajectory and backing up just a little bit, there were two eggs. Zuni, they followed the one egg in one direction, and the other one, you were saying, hatched into a macaw, was it?
Yeah, macaw, which is also a clan here, too.
Okay. And where did those people end up?
They went to South America, or the place of everlasting sunshine, so... And if I remember right, there's a group down there. Sorry to interrupt you again, but there's also a group down there that have their language is somewhat similar to ours. Of course, during the passing of time, things have changed, but there's still some words that kind of relate to Zuni.
And I hope more information can come about that. You just kind of blew my mind with that, Candace, and I'm really curious to see where that can go as well. Now, it's my understanding you're also an artist, and you just recently finished a painting of a turkey. I was wondering if you could tell us about it. Why did you pick the turkey again?
Well, you know, just going around the village selling at various venues, each clan group will be really proud, and if you have to paint one of their symbols of them, like, oh, cool, you really did that, and all the other clans will say, like, hey, how come you didn't paint mine yet? And the Turkey Clan has been kind of on my case about that for the past couple of years. So I've been, and I have had that canvas for a long time. I've had it sketched out for a number of years. I've been slowly chipping away at it, and art has a fun way of testing you. So every time when I thought I didn't have the skill set or to do the painting justice, I would put it away for a couple months, study up on different techniques, come back to it, paint over it again, and then try it out. So this one was really challenging in different fun ways. So it finally decided I was worthy enough and let me finish it. So that's how I got to finish it.
When it was meant to be finished as well, right?
Yeah, so art is, I just think of myself as a vessel, and the art just kind of creates itself. So I was finally, the painting finally deemed me worthy to finish it. I finally got to finish it. I was so happy.
Candace, the Zuni don't just have the origin story and the significance of the turkey as far as that goes as well. I understand there's a story of Turkey Girl. Would you be willing to share that?
Yeah, sure. Actually, that'll be one of during the winter times is when the time we can tell our stories. That's when all the elderly will gather all the grandkids around and they'll tell stories of our history. And that's one of our historical points. And there's a program here called the Zuni Youth Enrichment Program. They have, like, these plays depicting our traditional stories. And this coming winter is when the Turkey Girl will be talked about. And just to give a quick synopsis, because there's a lot more people that can do just this story just as better than I can, so I'll just tell a quick summary. It's kind of like, and I might get it wrong, just just to let you know, I don't want anybody to come to my house and throw pebbles at me.
Yeah, leave Candace alone.
Yeah. Yeah, you heard him. Leave me alone.
Candace, well, let's do this then. Why don't we save that for after the break, because we are going to be heading over to a quick break in just a few. So don't touch that dial, because we have a brief synopsis of the story of Turkey Grill coming up in just a few. How about just a quicker question then? Where can people find your work, Candace?
Sure. You can head over to my website where me and my cousin do art. At Natachu Inc., NATACHUINK.com.
Right on. If you'd like to join our discussion today, call in at 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-99-NATIVE. Every day we tackle issues from a Native viewpoint, and you're always welcome to tune into this station at this time every weekday. You're welcome to head on over to NativeAmericaCalling.com to find a station near you. And you can also listen live anywhere in the world online at nativevoice1.org. If you'd like to listen to any of our past shows, you can find the audio archive by searching for Native America Calling on soundcloud.com. You can subscribe to the Native America Calling podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or the podcast service of your choice. How are turkeys significant to your tribe's culture? Do you use turkey feathers? We want to hear from you. Be sure to give us a call at 1-800-996-2848. We have to head over to a quick break, but we'll be right back. I'm your host, Brett Maybe.
Cachet, life's an adventure, but your health shouldn't be. Check out open enrollment options November 1st through January 15th. Contact your local Indian health care provider for more information. Visit healthcare.gov or call 1-800-318-2596. A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Elahqua.
Thank you for tuning in to Native America Calling. I'm Brett Maybe. We're talking about turkeys today, Otson, as we call them here in Haudenosaunee territories. Indigenous people have an ancient relationship with turkeys. Some tribes domesticated them. Many include this bird in culture and ceremony. Where does the turkey stand in your native culture? There's still time to join our conversation. Give us a call at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. All right, Candace, we've all been on the edge of our seats as we are anxiously awaiting a brief synopsis of Turkey Grill. Can you tell us a little bit more?
Sure, no problem. So back before Spanish contact, there was a girl who was not from a very powerful family, not very wealthy family. She was very much in poverty. She didn't have any parents or grandparents to speak of. So she kind of was scrounging around life, just trying to survive. And the turkeys kind of took pity on her. This is kind of like a Zuni Cinderella story, sort of, in a way. So they took care of her and made sure that she was well taken care of, I should say. So it's kind of one of the evidence of turkeys being really empathetic and being more intelligent than what mainstream society gives them credit for.
That certainly sounds like one of the themes in our conversation today. And basically what Dr. Conrad was saying as well, that these birds do possess a kind of intelligence, and they do have that natural way to form bonds with individuals. The Zuni are great evidence of that. Them being domesticated up here among our peoples as long as they were, also one again. And well, at this time, let's head on over to the lines. Calling in from Utqiagvik in Alaska, and I apologize, Edith, listening in on KBRW. You're on Native America Calling.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I just wanted to emphasize on the importance of our indigenous people, the cultures in the whole world. And we happen to be given our beautiful land up here in the top of the world, north, way up on the top of the world. And I just wanted to highly recognize the indigenous people, because we are in our own land and doing exactly what we did millions of years ago. And so I just wanted to let you know that the whale is sacred to our people up here, Inupiaq people, in the dictionary Eskimo. Anyway, I just wanted to reiterate how very powerful the sacred animals are to us. Ours is the whale, and it gives to the whalers that are respectful, a clean cellar that they share with other people. It's just a very spiritual thing. We still do that, and thank God we're still up here in our own country and everywhere. And so each indigenous peoples or any distinctive people, it's very important how we need to take good care of our earth, our land, our animals, and each other, learning from each other, a lot of respect and respecting the animals and our way of life. Thank you for the show. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for your thoughts, Edith, and I absolutely 100% agree that building and continuing to build on those relationships with all aspects of life, including and especially those animals that have special significance to us, is always something that we need to be reminded of. So thank you very much again, Edith. Let's take another call. Calling in from Santee, Nebraska, listening in on KZYK. You're on Native America Calling. Melvin, welcome today.
Good morning. I was just wanted to comment where 50, 60 years ago, you see more powwow regalia made from turkey feathers. I remember seeing a lot of regalia that had turkey design, you know, feathers in it, the toms, and they look great. You know, I don't hardly see them anymore. I rarely see them at a powwow at all. The other thing here on the reservation, we have a ton of turkeys. I think, you know, we don't hunt like we used to. Now you hear about people hitting turkeys with their car more often than somebody shooting a nice turkey. You know, 'cause we have a lot of turkeys here. And, maybe we could start hunting and making regalia again. That'd be nice. But I don't see any regalia much coming out of our reservation made with turkey feathers anymore. There used to be, but not anymore.
Melvin, that's my comment for today.
Melvin,
let me ask you, was that a historical thing, or was that an ancient thing, or was that just, fashion for a period of time in the 20th century? Are you aware of that?
What? Access. It was what we had. Sure. And we dealt with it by using turkey feathers, or a lot of times we weren't allowed to go out and get an eagle or anything like that. We weren't allowed to do that here. And so a lot of them had to deal with what they had. Not were turkeys. We used to have a lot of pheasant, but the pheasant hunters took care of that next. You know, so. But the turkeys, there, I mean, 50 years ago, I seen a lot of regalia, mainly on young people. Might have been their first dance outfit or something, but I don't see it at all anymore out here.
Oh, thank you so much for your thoughts, Melvin, and it's always great to hear from you. Derek, I kind of want to follow up on that question a little bit, and I know you're not exactly neighbors. However, I'm just curious, has there ever been a historical use of the turkey in regalia among your people?
I'm not too sure on that. I'm pretty young, and I'm just getting introduced to my culture.
All right. Thank you very much, Derek. And bringing it back to Dr. Conrad right now, we were talking, and obviously you heard a lot of what Candace had to share on the relationship that the Zuni have always had with the turkeys as well. And we were mentioning the reverence that they displayed in even a death. They were treated as if they were a human. What other kinds of unique ways did you see people honoring turkeys in the archaeological record?
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. Something that I wanted to emphasize, and Candace mentioned this as well, and thank you for that. You know, archaeologically, we find some examples, for example, of intentional burials of turkeys in the past, and those burials are often in special places or are tied to specific individuals. And so we see that a past indigenous person who passed was then buried essentially with, and we can only wonder if that was their turkey or sort of the role of that turkey with that person. But we see that same type of reverence in the past, and I would say that expands to the role of turkey iconography on ceramics, for example, or petroglyphs, and where that appears in association with some of these ancestral places. We just see a very close tie between turkeys and their keepers, essentially, and this really speaks to that relationship. And there, in the Mesa Verde region, the Four Corners area of the Southwest, there are some examples of what have been called turkey tethers, where a turkey was likely tied to a sort of a rock so that it wouldn't fly away. You know, the assumption there is perhaps it's a tom or some type of turkey that, you know, was kept within these ancestral places, these communities, and was able to integrate and move around, but not fly away. They were making sure that turkey was kept safe and kept nearby.
Dr. Conrad, clearly the bulk of your research centered around the Pueblo lands. However, just in your research, did you come across any surprises? They've made it a long way. They've migrated or were brought intentionally all over. But were there any surprises where you see them show up in unexpected places?
That's a great question. You know, one of the most interesting and exciting parts of this research was that what a central and important place, Chaco Canyon, here in northwest New Mexico, there has been a lot of sort of research into understanding the role of turkeys. And one project that I was a part of really helped to identify the role and sort of the fact that turkeys were likely kept within the canyon, were intentionally bred and intentionally managed within Chaco Canyon, you know, again, such an important place for indigenous communities. And so that was a big surprise because it challenged a narrative within the archaeological community that turkeys were only brought in to this landscape as people sort of moved back and forth from the canyon to elsewhere. And so that was a really important part of this. And it reemphasizes, I believe, this important relationship and role between humans and turkeys in the past and what that means for this essentially mutualistic relationship through time.
Thank you very much for your insight, especially into Chaco Canyon. That's something that I'm highly interested in. I feel like is a vital chapter in these migration routes as well. So thank you again, Dr. Conrad. We're fastly running out of time, but I do have a few more questions. I'd like to bring Candace Kwam back on. She's an artist. She's Zuni. We're talking about Turkey Girl. We're talking about the Zuni origin story. As somebody from a people and nation who have such a significance and reverence for our feathered friends, what would you like people to understand about these birds?
Yeah, sure. So they're way more intelligent and empathetic than most people give them credit for. My cousin actually is taking care of like his own small herd of turkeys. So they're very smart, like more smart than I gave them credit for. Just getting introduced into it, they're very smart and they form attachments to people. And they're kind of like feathered dogs, if I had to describe it. They're pretty friendly if they get to know you.
So in the time that you've spent with the turkeys, have you been able to see their different personalities? Are they really diverse in that sense as well?
Yeah, they're just like any other animal. They have their own personality that they have. Some are more grumpy, some are more friendly. It just varies from turkey to turkey. They're exactly like people, and I can see why our ancestors instilled the fact that we bury them like people. So just to give them that homage, and we believe that they came before we did, these animals. So we just wanted to give them that added sense of honor to them.
Most definitely. Candace, I meant to ask you this a little bit ago, and I'm sorry to jump back again like this, but you were talking that the story of Turkey Grill is going to be a play. Is that going to be just a small local thing, or is that something that people are also able to check out?
I believe it's a small local thing. I know they're just getting ready for it, but they've done a couple of broadcasts just for the Zuni community for the past 2 or 3 winters, I believe. So, and they're fantastic. It's gotten better every year. So it's something I look forward to.
Well, I hope we can catch up some other time. And I'd really love to check that out, because this conversation has really piqued something in me that, isn't talked about enough. And again, it's these relationships that go way back. And we're talking thousands of years here. And we've had an insightful conversation with our guest today, Nicholas, Dr. Siler Conrad and Candace Quam. Dr. Conrad, just another question or two as we wrap up our time together today. Are you working on any other research involving turkeys right now?
Yes, yeah, thank you for asking. One of the projects that I've been trying to do, and again, it goes back to this idea of taking previous records and trying to re-examine them to gain a different understanding. And so right now I'm going back to turkey metric studies, where archaeological turkey bones have been measured. And, originally that was the basis for a lot of arguments about different species of turkeys, and that has changed as turkey genetic studies have essentially provided a specific answer to some of those questions. But what's interesting to me is that turkey metrics provide insight into demographics. And so what were these turkey flocks like for past ancestral peoples here within the Southwest? Were there toms? Were these mostly hens? What is the diversity within those flocks? And then, again, what does this mean for that type of human management in that relationship? And so I'm trying to look back at these metric analyses to see what else we can gain, a slightly more nuanced understanding of this relationship.
Any projected time frame on when this work will be published?
Oh my, that's a great question. Hopefully within the next couple of years. We'll see how it goes.
Well, thank you very much for your insight today, Dr. Conrad, and especially for being an ally to our feathered friends, and of course for helping the non-Indigenous person to realize the significance of turkeys as well. We've officially reached the end of the hour. It went quick, didn't it? I'd like to say thank you to our guests, Siler Conrad, Derek Nicholas, and Candace Quam. Join us next week for another lineup of discussions about Indigenous issues and topics. Our executive producer is Art Hughes. Our associate producer is Andy Murphy. Marino Spencer is the engineer. We had help this week from Kim Baca and Luella Bryan. Nola Daves Moses is the distribution director, and Bob Peterson is the network manager for Native Voice One. Clifton Chadwick is our national underwriting sales director. Antonio Gonzalez is the anchor for National Native News. Charles Sather is our chief operating officer. The president and CEO of Kwanic Broadcast Corporation is Jacqueline Sully. And I'm your host, Brett Mabee. Have a good weekend.
Heshe, istanko hotela na ahoi tuto na kwa honayu ya na wa me. Us is open enrollment options November 1st and January 15th and asti to na home production wetsi tela kenawa. Yam to dakwa mos awa shu up to etadaptonis healthcare.gov kenawa na etadaptonis 1-800-318-2596 sampen na akenapto. Look at Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to na penedito lo kenawa. Ela kwa.
Support by Navajo Language Renaissance, presenting Rosetta Stone Navajo for Apple and Android devices with two learning levels, a self-correcting pronunciation feature, and a new Level 1 workbook designed to make learning Navajo easier. Info at NavajoRenaissance.org. Support by VisionMaker Media, presenting Community, returning home through togetherness, an online event and panel discussion commemorating Native Americans and Alaska Native veterans, available online with no charge at visionmakermedia.org as part of their 45th anniversary.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davis. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.